We are fortunate enough to have Stuart Goodnick and Rob Schmidt. We are... Get to walk in front of everybody. Stuart Goodnick and Rob Schmidt, who are founders of this store and the teachers at the Thai Meditation Center, a fourth way spiritual tradition. And tonight they will be speaking on the bliss of sacrifice. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are we live?
Yeah. We are live.
Okay, cool. So, more than a few weeks ago, I guess at this point, I was listening to a spiritual talk, and much use of the word bliss was made in this talk. And it's by, the talk was, I won't name names, but the talk was by, was a good one, and was one that I quite enjoyed, and I think people found profitable. But it struck me that that word bliss is an extremely ill-understood or ill-defined or very rarely explored idea. What is bliss? As it was used in this talk, it seemed to be something of a carrot. It was offered as a carrot. That is, why wouldn't you want bliss? And how do you get there? And I have no problem with that use of the term and that use of the idea as a carrot when appropriate. So this is not a criticism of that, but it's sort of meant as an expansion of and an exploration of what bliss might mean in spiritual context and some of the ways that it might be conceived of a little differently than we ordinarily do. I think that the general understanding in this talk seemed and in most contexts where that word is used, intending it as an inducement to self-examination and an inducement to following a spiritual tradition or path, is one where bliss is understood to be something that feels supremely good, sort of like a permanent orgasm. But there's a lot more going on potentially with that. Even if that were true, how would you survive a potential permanent orgasm? That is to say, or it's been my personal observation that orgasm is very intense. That is, if there's a quality about that you can put your finger on, it is its intensity. It is the unusually intense. Its unusually intense nature that sets it apart from other experiences. Surely it's not just the product of bodies rubbing against other bodies, because our bodies rub against other bodies all the time. Somehow there's an intensity about that which is different, and an intensity that can be sustained for a short period of time for most of us living our ordinary lives without the conditions by which we could sustain the experience of that kind of intensity. Would it really be feasible to feel the intensity of a powerful orgasm on a permanent basis? Well, maybe, but you would have to get used to channeling a lot more energy, and we'll get back to that perhaps as we go on in this talk. So that's one aspect of bliss and how it's used, and some of the difficulties. you know, people are invited to put aside their belief sometimes that they can't experience bliss. And that is true, that is, that I, you know, my observation is that in many cases, one of the things stopping us from experiencing more intensity is precisely our habit that we're not able, our belief that we're not able to handle more intensity. But it's a lot more than just belief, or that's one thing I'm going to propose for your consideration as we go on tonight. The second point I want to veer off from here is the idea that the things, the way to achieve this kind of intensity might involve giving up the things that we're holding on to now, as I just mentioned here a moment ago. Maybe we might have to give up the belief that we can't experience the kind of intensity that that some spiritual traditions seem to offer or suggest is possible. But it might be more than just beliefs, you know, more than just the little locomotive, I know I can. It might be more than that. We might have to give up something else. So that's another, that was the instigating reason for the second major word in the title of this talk, the bliss of sacrifice. Right now, as we live our lives, as you each are living your lives in this moment, you have a set of habits of how you experience your life, right? If bliss, whatever that is, if it's just intensity, or whatever more it may be, if bliss is going to fill up your life, then something else has to go, right? Or at least, you have to get bigger. One of the two, presumably. Unless you can propose a third alternative for me. Stuart's smart. He can probably propose a third alternative.
I don't know if I have a third alternative, but I'll just start out with my own reflections on the topic. I'll start by saying I have no idea what bliss is. I mean, it's a word, and as such, it's meaningless because each of us comes to a word with a whole different set of experiences. And so the problem I have with holding bliss out as a carrot is no one knows exactly what that means, at least in early stages of practice, if we even accept the hypothesis that there's some state bliss to attain to or some non-state bliss to attain to, however you want to parse it. So looking at bliss and the way it's trotted out in spiritual traditions these days is, to me, problematic. One of the things I find problematic is that, you know, as a carrot, you know, it induces people to assume that they have achieved bliss and to equate it with some sort of experience they've had. They feel happy, they feel smug all the time, or something like that. They can call that bliss. And it tends to take the process of spiritual practice and relegate it to that of attaining yet another experience. So I go to a workshop, or I go to an intensive, and I get a state of bliss, or I get a hit of bliss, and it's sort of like taking my theanine vitamins in the morning or something like that. You know, I get a good rush on and have that experience. And yet, I think from a more mature spiritual practice, that's clearly not what the great texts that reference bliss are referring to. And yet when it's brought out, when it's held out as a carrot, when Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss, we want to go after this thing. We want to hunger for this thing and have this thing that, as Rob indicated, we think we don't have or we feel like we don't have. So if there is a place or if there's a state that's beyond the state that we ordinarily experience, and if we want to call that a state of bliss, then clearly there has to be some process or there has to be some change of state in ourselves to attain to that state. And so certainly what I find more practical, and this is certainly a reflection of grounding in the fourth way tradition that Tayu has, I find it more practical to focus on the things that we know. So I've always, as many of you have heard, like to reverse this idea of follow your bliss and state follow your dread, because dread in ourselves are the blockages. Dread in ourselves are the things that are quite real. We know they're there because we avoid them. we tend to organize our consciousness to avoid the things that make us least comfortable. That's at least something real, because that's something we can go move towards. And what I would claim, again, to get part sort of circle around Rob's point, is that to find or to walk the path of something that might take us to this thing, bliss, whatever that is probably a path that has to take us through its opposite, because it's opposite in our lives that would be acting as barriers for us to have any sort of possibility of encountering this thing, the big B. So as we move through its opposite, as we examine and put attention on its opposite, we have the possibility of coming to terms with, as Rob was saying, coming to terms with the reality that its opposite exists in our lives, or its opposite, the dread is there, the sense of being small, the sense of being limited is there. And if we put attention on those things and truly begin to understand what that's about, and to put the kind of attention not that analyzes it, but sort of shines light on it like the sun is shining light on it, there's the possibility for that current state of affairs to turn into something else. But it's a process that we don't really control. We can create and set up the conditions, but it's not a process that we can control. So I guess my entree into this point is that whether bliss exists or not is not necessarily a question we have to tackle intellectually, because experientially we can move towards that which decidedly is not blissful. And by doing that, it may create or enable the conditions for us to encounter something that is beyond that which is not blissful.
Thank you. This is maybe a good... We can go on, or I can go on anyway. But this is a good point, maybe, to see if there's any questions, any comments, reactions, etc. Is this all clear so far?
I especially use the phrase "permanent bliss." Mm-hmm. Kind of bothers me, because it seems that bliss is a word that describes one aspect of something, and if you were in a permanent state of bliss, wouldn't it get, or an intense orgasm all the time, you wouldn't have anything to reference it to, so it wouldn't really be any different than, or maybe we are actually in that right now, and we just, call it something else. How would you, without something else,
That makes perfect sense to me, and in fact, I agree with you entirely. That's one of the reasons that I've wanted to explore this topic in this talk, precisely because when you characterize bliss as this permanent place or state or experience, and I have to duly nod to those people who make the point that it's not just as that whatever they're describing is not just a state and or an experience. So that nod being made. Nevertheless, I have the same question that you do, actually, and I think it's a good one. It's a relevant one, and I think your point is extremely well taken. How would we know if we were or weren't experiencing bliss if we had achieved something that is permanent? In other words, the permanence is an issue. The idea of permanence, the idea of a refuge or maybe a base state, could help us there. If there's some place to go, that is ever available, that is always generative and fruitful and generous to us and to everything else we touch, that could have some of the feeling of what we're looking for here. But in some ways it may be, you know, a failure of words when we use a word like permanent.
It seems like it would have to be something non-dual.
But I think the word permanent is, you know, to be fair, I think that word the use of that word, when it's not used simplistically, is intended to direct our minds to something that endures, whether we are aware of experiencing it at any given moment or not. So, but I think that your question is well taken, and I'm in complete agreement with your point. Thank you.
Yeah. If you achieve a state of bliss, that implies you've been in a state that wasn't blissful.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's your point of reference that you'll always have.
Yeah, I think the Yeah, the challenge is to me is that bliss one of these? Is it simply a state? Is it simply a relative state, or is it something more fundamental? Is it more fundamental in the nature of our beings? And an example that helps me think in those terms is like space. You know, space is something fairly fundamental. We exist within space. We can't exist outside of space, and yet we don't always put attention on space. We indirectly infer its existence or infer it as an abstraction by virtue of doing very practical things like putting rulers down or moving in the room or feeling wind on us, but that's not experiencing space directly. That's simply having experiences of the material realm that are consistent with something that is beyond that, which is ever-present and always there. And so in a similar way, bliss may be in the category of something that is always there, cannot not be there, is something that's always, you know, inherent in our natures. And the paradox or the challenge of spiritual practice is to, either turn our attention towards this, recognize and let go of the fact that we're never going to find it in a direct sense, like a regular experience, and relax with that, with the knowledge that that's just an aspect of our natures. And so then it becomes something that doesn't exactly have a reference in the same way. It doesn't have a dual reference. It gets to your point that, you know, it's something that's non-dualistic, because there's no sense in bliss not being present. And yet, by virtue of that, it's not something that we can get our minds around, you know, or grab hold of or experience in a direct way.
So maybe in that case, if bliss has some aspect to it that is not that is beyond the ordinary experience, whether good or bad, then maybe what would be helpful is to realize that the descriptions of this, whatever it is, that we're calling bliss for now, might be descriptions that are only temporary, only partially true. So the idea that bliss has to feel a certain way, has to have certain characteristics like the feeling good of orgasm that I referred to earlier, maybe that's an incomplete understanding. Maybe it's one that arises conditionally out of the fact that most of the time, to a greater or lesser extent, we're feeling some kind of suffering or are unconscious to a certain extent, that is not fully present. Not present to everything that's going on, which would be an intense place or an intense way to live your life. Mm-hmm. When everything that's going on is something that you cannot pretend to ignore. We pretend to ignore lots of stuff. In fact, we successfully appear to ignore lots of stuff most of the time. And much of spiritual practice is about expanding our acknowledgement of that around us which we are willing to admit our connections to, but it's not easy.
So that actually raises an interesting question to me, which is that it may be the case that as we begin practice, we're not really equipped energetically or as beings to encounter or recognize or understand, experience, whatever word it is, bliss, but that's something that we acquire the potential for as we deepen our practice. And so it may be something that is not really available in the ordinary state because of the factors that you were describing, because of the factors that are in the way. Or if you know, certain traditions, certainly the Fourth Way tradition is big on this. It has the model that we have to activate our organism in such a way to build the capability to develop the soul, as it were, such that the ability to directly encounter aspects of reality, such as bliss, are available. But that's not something that is available in the ordinary biological state. It's something that we actually have to apply intentional effort through a period of methodical practice to cultivate the state, the capabilities inherent in our potential to actually experience bliss.
You had a question.
One of the ways I see Christ on the cross is humanity blowing a fuse. One being accommodating more intensity than one being should naturally have to accommodate.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's the natural function of the community to help each one of its members to accommodate the real intensity of being. And when the community fails, and sometimes the individual is, their circuitry gets kind of, discombobulated.
There's a lot of discombobulated circuitry out there.
Yeah, a lot of discombobulated circuitry. So it's about designing the circuits, and
or redesigning, as it were.
Redesigning the circuits. But I think the natural intensity of the moment actually accommodates the whole universe, because the moment is the whole universe. So it has to do with our ability to accommodate the real intensity of the moment, which you don't really want to think about.
Well, I don't disagree with that, and I think the point I was making earlier is that as organisms, to be able to, to use your language, to have the circuitry that's able to assimilate and metabolize that intensity requires no small amount of effort and building of a foundation, and that the ordinary state of being existence is in our contemporary civilization is one of completely crossed circuits, such that we operate in a mechanical kind of buffered way, such that we block out large amounts of reality and focus on a very narrow channel of ideation.
But everything in nature, I think, naturally can accommodate that intensity.
Everything, perhaps, except humans.
Except for humans.
Because
we conceptually separate ourselves from the big picture.
That's one of the factors that's, I would say, one, not the only factor, but that's certainly one of the factors that creates this unusual existence that most of us have for ourselves. But I wouldn't say that's unnatural. I would just say that nature has accommodated to our psychosis, and we continue to function as parts of nature, but it may not be it may not be to the optimum potential that we're capable.
Allows our psychosis.
Yeah, well, allows it and makes and uses it for its own purposes, I would say.
Okay.
Just like any nature is very accommodating, and when you know, we see examples of this all the time with you know, creatures who do something that may be ultimately self-destructive. You know, we end up with yeast killing itself to create wine. I mean, it's there's stuff comes out of apparent local disasters, and the challenge for us, I think, is that we have the choice. We may not recognize that we have the choice, but we have the choice to realize something different. And that choice and the recognition of the possibility of that choice is why we're all in this room, certainly, because we resonate to that possibility. And I would assert that it's a profound choice that we're faced with, but it's also not an easy path, because there's a lot of old circuitry to sort of move through and to study and to see, and, you know, such that we can allow a natural process of redesigning to take place. And that's not, you know, it's a challenge. That's actually work we have to do before we can enjoy the fruits of practice. But I think for any of you who, and certainly most of you who have taken steps in that direction, it's like exercising, you know, it's work, but you feel great, you know, when you pause for a moment and say, oh yeah, I just did that. And then we make the next step, and that allows us to make the third and the fourth and the fifth and the millionth step.
Yeah. I've been thinking about two different kinds of bliss as we've been talking this evening. One is more analogous to the concept of flow by Mihai, Csikszentmihalyi, and that seems to be perhaps a more readily accessible state for most people when they get into a groove on something where time disappears and they're just really doing what they're doing and nothing else. I think about that maybe as one level of bliss. And I think about the orgasmic state of bliss where, well, maybe in both of them, it seems that an essential characteristic for me is that the personal I seems to disappear in some sense in both of those conditions. I don't know how pervasive that is, but it seems to be a quality for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes sense, and of course that is, you know, congruent with how many, if not most or all, major traditions conceptualize the ego, or something like the ego, depending on the tradition and how you characterize it, and I think that, you know, it's not that's the part of the title that might even seem obvious. Bliss may be achieved when we sacrifice ego. That's a very simple equation, and of course, not so easy to actually operationalize. I think Stuart's point earlier is precisely that we need to. It's like we can't get from here to there just by wishing it to be so. Now, oh, I really want to feel bliss now. That's not going to do anything, right? There's somehow we have to let something go. Instead of contracting to grasp something, we actually have to do the opposite thing, which is to release and let something or things go. And that's, you know, that's one of the difficulties with the current, you know, craze with creating your own life and your own existence. When understood simplistically, that can that's actually a grasping after, and you're actually adding more stuff, more obstacles to experiencing whatever this non-egoic thing is, or place is, or direction is that we're talking about here. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. You're saying that the act of creating a goal interferes with the with allowing bliss to be present, for example?
Well, yes and no. I'm saying that not the act of creating a goal, but the act of gripping the goal tightly. And this is where, this is the big, in many ways, this is the big difficulty of practice. When am I appropriately holding the tool hard enough to use it, strongly enough to use it, as strongly as I need to use it for the task at hand? And when am I compulsively holding on to something whose utility is no longer present, and is in fact now an encumbrance, an obstacle in and of itself? So grasping that distinction on a moment-by-moment basis, operationally, very difficult. That's why in the fourth way, we call them spiritual schools, because it's something, it's a trick you need to learn. It's a set of, it's a training that you pick up, much as in the Middle Ages, people became apprentices to journeymen and then eventually became masters themselves. And they didn't do it because they went to school first to read about the task that they were apprenticing to learn. They went and did the scut work first for 5 years. And then they were allowed to do some simple little thing, which they did wrong at first, probably. And over time, their understanding grew because the whole organism was being trained, not just the mind. That's one of the danger points for us in our culture, where education and training tends to be associated with one part of the organism only, and the rest of it gets, tossed aside. I was just listening to some guy on the radio, and as I was driving my car today, talking about how we need to reform education in this country. And to me, it's so, the current educational system is so completely inappropriate to training whole individuals that I wouldn't even know where to begin. I wouldn't even want to try. The people who do try that I respect are people who start over by themselves in groups of like-minded individuals, often associated with spiritual schools or something like it, and who are willing to base their work on principles that are quite different than the ones that motivate our educational infrastructure now. But the point is that it's not about just kids. It's about us now, because we didn't get the training that ideally we might have wished to get when we were kids. So we need to learn to train ourselves to be apprentices of life now. And it's a process that requires something like apprenticeship, in my experience and my observation of people who have been successful. So maybe apprentices of bliss is not a bad way, a bad direction, a bad rubric to use to think about this process.
So that means that there's plenty of scut work to be done.
Exactly right. Yeah.
I wasn't going to add this, but when you just said that, I couldn't resist, because the thing that comes up is Plato's man facing the cave, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. when the light is behind him. And if we say that light and bliss are synonymous, when you talk about looking at, you use the term reality, these things we're stuck with are real. You said that's what we know, that's our reality.
Right, right.
And that's tricky, because there's another kind of axiom, which is we become what we meditate on. So as we focus on the scut mm-hmm. work, there's a real danger in becoming immersed in it. And if we think of the Plato analogy, if I would simply turn around and look at my inherent nature, the other would dissolve in interest. The scut work exists because I'm still interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I would get more interested in the part of me that is eternal, that has some quality of bliss, which I would say is not physiological, which is where the orgasm breaks down, if I would make that my focus of attention, and somehow those who have touched the state are like the guys outside Plato's cave, then I wouldn't have to be focused on the things that block us.
Right. I get your point, and you know, clearly I'm actually in agreement with what you're saying, but what I was saying was not meant to say that when we put attention on these things that we take for real, that the way we... I didn't get into the methodology, because the kind of attention that we put on that is a different kind of attention than the attention that we habitually put on it. The nature of the attention we habitually put on the shadows, to use the Plato analogy, is you know, what we call identification, and it's we are, you know, taking that to be us, and we make that real, and we make that the only thing that's real. So when I talk about scut work in a spiritual context, I actually am fondly referring to practices like self-observation, where the first act that we do is not change the dynamic of our faces looking at the shadows, but simply become aware from a different place, and to begin to disidentify with the looking at the shadow. And the purpose of that, ultimately, is to establish the flexibility, or spatially, to have the extra dimension by which we can actually turn our attention to something else. But it's not something that, you know, the problem I have with the analogy as you stated it is kind of the problem I have, to, you know, quote Jacob Needleman from his book Lost Christianity. You know, original Christian tradition, you know, speaks about some wonderful values like love your neighbor as yourself. To tell someone to do that without a context of training and without a context of a methodology by which to develop the presence in themselves so they actually have the intrinsic possibility to love their neighbor like themselves breeds a bunch of liars, like we have with modern Christianity and, you know,
and
moralists.
And frustration, self-frustration, right. Why aren't I good enough?
Right.
Title of a recent book by Jacob Needleman.
And so, you know, the reason that I sound like I'm talking a lot about scut work is because in my experience it's necessary to build the foundation to be able to turn around and look at the light. If you just tell someone to turn around and look at the light, sometimes if people assume that they can just do that and don't appreciate the magnitude of the degree of identification, sometimes it results in a kind of a delusion, like you see with a lot of neo-Advaitists who you know, have the glib catchphrase that everything's consciousness and that solves all the problems, and then they stop examining themselves. And so, and I know that, you know, I mean your work is founded in a long practice of this kind of approach, and so you know, I understand that our distinction here is a semantic one, but I'm just explaining why I emphasize the scut work, because without the scut work, it's the rest of it is sort of like a cruel carrot to dangle out, you know, across a big chasm that people can't jump across.
The scut work thing is important to for me too, and you know, I emphasized it partly because, you know, when I was in my early 20s, I was actually an apprentice, one of the last apprenticeship programs, sort of industrial apprenticeship programs that I know about existing, and so I had some experience of what it was like to start off in that way. Surely a far cry from the sort of thing that I was referencing in the experience of people in the Middle Ages. But nevertheless, the point I was trying to make is that that scut work is paying attention to the details of life in this physical organism. Stuart points out that we all want to immediately turn our attention to the greatness, the beauty, the truth, the light, etc. But my experience is that you have to become, you have to attune this as an organism to be a lens through which that light and truth and beauty can be viewed. In other words, this is not something that is discardable, at least in the program that I would advocate. It is in fact precisely the tool we need to cultivate, but differently than we have been doing in the using the unconscious habits that we have been doing to motivate it, to direct it, etc. So using the body, focusing attention on the body, and educating what we in our tradition call the body center, or the habits of the body, however you want to call it, as well as the habits of the heart, which are also quite sticky. Excuse me. That's the direction I'm talking about here. And further, I would say that, you know, referencing our discussion earlier about most of the rest of nature doesn't seem to have the problems that we do appreciating things. I think the issue is that we have a bigger, for whatever reason, collectively, human beings are taking on a bigger challenge than the rest of the natural world to bring, in the Gurdjieff terminology, most other beings are two-brained beings, and human beings are three-brained beings. We're bringing in this great big, cerebellum and etc. along with us, and that makes it possible to appreciate life in a way that no two-brained or one-brained or other being can do. But we still have to start with the body. We can't go right to the intellectual apparatus and just sort of shoot out into the universe, which is the mistake that I think often happens.
Well, a while back I found that my concept of bliss shifted to consciousness, which to me is a higher experience, mm-hmm. and intense experience. And what I have actually found is that sometimes when I'm more awake, say, to use a new terminology, there's something in me that resists that. It's like I don't have the capacity, the way I am, to endure this wonderful state. You know, it's mm-hmm. a wonderful state, but I have been able to see there's something that doesn't want the wonderful state. It wants to be comfortable and go back mm-hmm. to its old habitual ways.
Thank you very much. That is very well said. That is precisely maybe the biggest part of the problem. The sacrifice we need to make is the sacrifice of just that habit of holding on to the devil we know, and sacrificing, as we currently do, the angel we might get to know.
Or I might add, sacrifice the idea that it's supposed to be any other way. Because it's sometimes when the thing that I'm most in resistance to is when I encounter my resistance and am in resistance to my resistance, and I don't do anything. But if I recognize that resistance is actually part of the process, that has to be there by the nature of what consciousness is when embodied in a physical organism, that gives me the inspiration to make efforts. And the making the effort does create energy. It's like we always say with self-observation, every act of self-observation is cumulative. A certain kind of energy, a certain quality of matter, if you will, is added to the system that wasn't there before. And if you are creating energy, there's going to be resistance.
When you say you see that you have resistance, and so then you start to work on it. By working on it, do you mean that you just observe it, or is part of the work to observe it and then try to come to?
Well, I'd say that there are different phases of the work. So in an early phase, one sees, one just, you know, focuses a lot on observing and bringing that consciousness to the body, bringing, you know, awareness, trying to be as awake as possible to feeling the sensations that are arising, being aware of what's happening in our bodies, being aware of what's happening in our chest with our feelings, and even what's happening with our minds. But even that, just the act of observing, particularly in early stage work, is there's a resistance associated with it. There's a resistance of attending to the body, and you can see this just by trying to be aware of your body for an extended period of time. At some point, most people, almost 99.9% of people, will get distracted from that, and because other forces come to bear, and so we make another effort to observe. And those are efforts. They may be small efforts, but they're real efforts, because we're sort of pushing against something that is in resistance to that. And in higher stages or more mature stages of practice, if it's working, you're still pushing against something. It may not be the same issue that you pushed against in early stage work, but you're pushing against something. The worst thing you can do as a spiritual practitioner is decide after 20, 25 years of practice that now you can coast, because that's just entropy, and inertia coming to the fore. We always are applying a certain kind of pressure, and that's the sacrifice, in one sense, here is the sacrifice of recognizing that that's part of the nature of how we continue to expand the domain of our experience and the nature of our being. Is this not making sense, or what?
No,
what's
you've backed away. I mean, with your language, you've backed away from it so many times in removal that I lost track of which one you were talking about.
Which
of the resistances?
Well, my point is, in one sense, resistance is always our friend, and is always present in this work. That there isn't a point where all of a sudden we're magically in free fall, because we're embodied in organisms, and we are, my claim, you can test this, is that that's in fact one way that we can know that we're continuing in this work, is when we make efforts. But the efforts I'm talking about are efforts of consciousness. I'm not saying you should go out and lift 200 pounds every day or something like that, but if you engage in a consistent practice of making efforts to observe yourself, that is a kind of effort, and that effort will necessarily, by virtue of it being work, will change the nature of your organism. It will change the way the circuitry is hooked up. It will change the day-to-day quality of your experience.
So then, if you experience resistance to that observing, that's just to be expected.
Yeah, that was my point.
Okay, I think I got it.
Yeah, and my point was simply that the sacrifice in this case, just to bring it all the way back to the very beginning of this, is giving up the idea that it should be any different.
Yeah, well, so you're also sacrificing your comfort. I myself feel very attracted to the idea of free fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Because I've struggled a lot, and I've observed a lot, and I've meditated a lot, and it's been real hard, and I'm just ready to, for gosh sakes, I'm just ready for a little relaxation. I mean, that's the state I can sort of frost myself up into very easily.
Yeah, but I want to be careful that resistance and effort in and of itself is not necessarily good or bad. It's the purpose of a school is to guide one in making the right efforts.
The right efforts, yeah.
And the right efforts should be the most effective efforts. You know, is what I mean is for a particular process. We can bang our heads against the wall, and that's an effort too. You know, I can hit my head constantly and expend a lot of energy doing that. But the kind of effort we're talking about actually creates energy in ourselves. And when we make those kinds of efforts, even though our natures might be to want us to take a break and, you know, not do it or give ourselves an excuse or whatever, but if we make those kinds of efforts, we will feel good for it. We will feel different, and we will feel that that's an appropriate thing to be doing. That's my claim.
I want to feel blissful.
Well, that's an exercise for the reader. I don't want to define what bliss is. I want to say, here's a path that allows you to develop the capacity to make a decision for yourself as to what bliss is. Mm-hmm. It's no fun if I tell you what bliss is, because based off of my work, I've come to some answer, because it's meaningless. You know.
Yeah, well, I was just really being facetious. I've always thought that there was some kind of work to be done, and it wasn't like it wasn't like bliss was what we were striving for, but maybe bliss would be one of the side effects.
Maybe a byproduct? I mean, And my point is simply, exactly, that's a construct too, and it's a fine construct, like any construct, you know, it's a, you know, that and a quarter will get you downtown, or that and a $2 will get you downtown. But what I'm interested in, what I describe with, you know, making these efforts in a particular direction, is to get ourselves to a place where we can have the fun of answering these questions ourselves, and be in the position to have the capacity to articulate, just like a musician plays a piece of music, what bliss is, because it's real for ourselves. Up until that point, the words are just, you know, at best carrots, and at worst, traps.
I wonder, you made it sound a little bit like we could be making efforts all the time.
Yeah,
you think, isn't there, aren't we only maybe capable of making efforts for certain periods of time, and...
Well, that's a nice construct. I would claim that it's possible to be making these kinds of efforts in consciousness all the time. Let me qualify that. Initially, when one begins to do this kind of work, it is probably an intermittent process. So one makes these efforts as often as one can remember to. But the point is that you're not just like, say, Sunday at 10 a.m. making an effort, and then you know, you go through the rest of the week.
I guess more quality versus quantity question comes up.
I'm gonna make another claim here, and that is, we'll get to you in a second. In response to this, I want to make the claim that there is a point, and it's a crucial turning point that most people don't get to in practice. But it is, my teacher used to characterize it by saying, you get the taste for what we might call sacrifice. We get the taste for self-examination. That is to say, when we're doing it, suddenly it turns from being this thing that we have to constantly add energy to being something that, if I'm not doing it, it doesn't feel right. Okay? So it's like there is a
it's like an effortless effort.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, but it's sort of like maybe at some point, you know, you have just a bunch of snow crystals together, and you drop that on the hillside, it's not going to go anywhere. It has to get to a certain point, a certain size, and then after that, gravity will engage it, and the angle of the slope together will allow that puppy to move, apparently on its own. It's not really, of course, on its own. It's actually in the context of all it is.
Well, I would use the analogy more of spiritual endorphins, that, you know, when you do exercise at a certain point, that when you get
he's
into
a runner.
When you get into a certain level of fitness, then there's still effort to run, but there's a sort of a reward, a satisfaction, and a state that sustain something in the organism helps to sustain that. And my experience has been in spiritual practice, there's a similar sort of thing. One is still making a kind of effort, but there's a clarity or a sustaining support that becomes available at this phase of practice that Rob is referring to, where the effort, there's still an effort, but it's like the only thing that's really meaningful for one to do, and so one is inspired to move in that direction.
So if practice is about not contracting but expanding. What I'm suggesting is that at some point the process of expansion becomes sufficiently crystallized such that it acquires a momentum apparently of its own, or such that it continues to undergo that expansion without the original forms of effort which fall away because they are no longer necessary. It doesn't mean there aren't new challenges, you know, to keep the process going as smoothly as one would wish. But excuse me, the point is that there's a state change. There's
it's almost like bliss has entered into the picture.
I think that's not a bad way to look at it. But in one sense, but the paradox is from you know the perspective of bliss feels good is that maybe it's acquiring a taste for sacrificing things that our egos and everything else do not want us to let go of. So if you know to continue this metaphor, this getting a taste for letting go of yourself is dangerous, and the organism does everything it can to resist that. That's you know to return to the discussion earlier. So that's why intensity is important, because it takes a certain you know, my teacher used to use the example of you know if you fly at a certain speed, you never achieve escape velocity from a planetary right. And if you don't achieve that speed, you're never going to do it. Absent an atmosphere, assuming that you're not aiming directly towards the planet, you're going to do that no matter what direction you're going, as long as the arc of your travel doesn't intersect the planet itself. So it's kind of like that. So this is these are all metaphors and analogy. We don't want to get lost in there.
It's not even a necessary comment, but what I'm getting is that in the same way you're saying that we can't define bliss, you have to find it yourself, I think that what we've just come to is the same thing is true about that word, effort. Because depending on where you are at in your practice and building that muscle, effort feels different in the same way that bliss feels different. So we can't always... When we hear that word, everybody hears it their own way. In the same
right.
way, when we hear the word bliss, we hear it in our own way.
That's a very good point, and I would concretize it. I don't know to what extent I can make it real for the non-Tayu practitioners here, but there's in our practice we have something. This practice called self-observation that Stuart has referenced, and the basics of it is just it's sort of like flipping on a switch. It doesn't take a you know, kind of effort. You just flip on the switch, and then it's on for as long as it's on. When that's on, you can direct attention, and that does take some energy. You can direct attention to your body. You can direct attention to your what's happening for you emotionally. You can direct attention on somebody, another person, on another thing. That's more of the quality of the effort that most people think of when they think of meditative effort. But then there's this other thing where really it's just sort of bing and the eyes open. I am receiving. I am present. And that doesn't take effort, really, except effort to remember to do that, which is another thing.
Well, which is effort. But
which is effort, but it's a different thing than,
right.
than that other practice.
I know in the fourth way tradition, Gurdjieff spoke of, you know, of the three forces, the denying force was the force that we sort of push against. And I think in the Hindu tradition, tamas is the inertia. So, you know, these traditions try to abstract a certain something that is something we're always kind of pushing against, and you know, counsels us to be mindful of that. But I agree that the term effort is problematic because we have so many social constructions with it. I like throwing it out partly for that reason, because it's a little bit provocative, because so many people have the idea that spiritual practice is about the end of effort. You know, it's like the get out of jail free card or something like that. And
which is simplistic reading of a non-dualist approach would seem to support, but it's a simplistic reading, and that's the problem with it.
Well, it's also that the, you know, my, when I look at the great, the teachers I feel are the most profound, and I look at as my own practice deepens, what continues to call to me the part of sacrifice, and part of sacrificing our egos is also sacrificing our self-interest, and you know, one becomes more inspired to put energy towards service of something. And again, I'm not going to define that. I'll leave that as a exercise for the practitioner. But there's a sacrifice of what were one's own, you know, traditional self-interests, and one's giving oneself, as I think Lee Lozowick, among others, puts it, becoming a slave of God. And whatever that means, we get to find out, or that gets to blossom in our practice. But that's again, you know, that the questions that come up for one looking at that is, how can I be of better service? You know, how can I improve this machine to be a better servant to the creation? And those are things that it, when, you know, it's like trying to do good in your job. You know, you're inspired to try to be as impeccable as possible, and to you know, to develop the organism as effectively as possible, to be able to give something back.
You had a comment much earlier, which we want to get back to.
It strikes me that we're constantly putting out a lot of effort that we're not even aware of. It takes a lot of effort to maintain the ego. It takes a lot of effort to construct the reality that we're experiencing. And as you put it earlier, turning on the switch is maybe a redirection of that effort. And all of a sudden, it seems like a lot of work, but what we're doing right now is a whole lot of work. We're just not aware of it. We just don't have any consciousness about that. So maybe turning on that switch is more work. It's just a different sort of effort all of a sudden.
That's exactly right. It is a redirection of the energy of attention. That's the phrase I've come to use lately. It's not changing the amount of energy going through the system in one sense, at least in that immediate moment, but it's a redirection of that energy.
Would you call it energy attention?
A redirection of the energy of attention.
Thank you.
So,
actually, a very helpful term instead of effort, because it makes it very clear what we're talking about. Okay. Then it's not that semantic issue.
Right.
It's less provocative.
It is less provocative.
Natural selfhood, it takes no energy at all to maintain.
I'm sorry. Natural selfhood. Is that what you said?
Yes. Yes. So it takes effort to maintain the construct of the ego, but natural selfhood, it takes no effort.
I don't know if I.
I wonder.
Yeah. I mean, that's a nice idea, but I'm not sure.
A word I wanted to introduce is strength, and without resistance, certainly, then there is no need for effort, and without effort, then there's no development of strength. So also I like, have you thought of the metaphor of the multi-stage rocket, where you have to release a stage in order
yeah,
to fire the next one, and all you know is that the stage that you're working with is running out of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually I don't mind that one in one sense, because then your focus is on, you know, which is of immediate relevance. And similarly, your claim that there's this no energy place of the true self may or may not be true, but I don't know.
Well, it's a self-generating energy. It's so that.
thought.
It maintains itself.
Yeah, my claim is that that's a proposition which one can get to a place to test more thoroughly, but the place that we find ourselves now is certainly one where we have a lot of energy locked up into these egoic structures that is kind of frozen. And I think to Rob's point, when we redirect our attention, as you were saying, when that energy gets released, that it does have the effect of feeling like all of a sudden we have a lot more energy to work with. And I think that is part of what gives us more energy to do more practice.
And very slowly, sort of, filament by filament, corpuscle by corpuscle, the organism is rewired when we redirect that energy of attention. It's a cumulative process. As I said earlier, there can come a point for the organism that where the relationship to how the energy tends to want to flow can change. But for most of us, in most of our lives, it's still a matter of getting to that point, that critical mass, and it is a matter of changing the circuitry, as we were saying earlier, that using that metaphor, and I think that's an important aspect of this. So let's not forget that part. We have to, if we're going to be able to channel more energy, we have to improve the quality of the circuitry, the capacity of the circuitry.
And I'd say the good news about that is that we don't have to be electrical engineers to do this.
good thing.
Or neurobiologists, as the case may be. It's a natural process. It's what we do have to do is to turn on the switch or to activate the consciousness, and to be present in a way that in a different kind of way to the operation of the organism. But that energy, bit by bit, as Rob said, corpuscle by corpuscle, starts to change the way that we process energy that comes into our system, and parts of ourselves begin to grow that haven't had a chance to grow. Our essential natures, our essential personalities that are not the social personality, but these deeper parts of ourselves can grow and to mature in a way that they haven't had a chance to.
The ego is involved with the wounding. The ego is involved with the wounding, and the wounding holds a pain in place. The ego is holding a pain in place. And sometimes just a slight release or a sense of relief from that pain, the egoic wound, can create a sense of bliss, of blissfulness. I think bliss can have to do with just a temporary or minute release of pain.
Well,
it can be a relative.
I understand what you're saying, and in one sense I don't disagree. But to me, that what I want to achieve, and what I would wish others to achieve, is the ability, as Stuart was saying earlier, not to have to ask to get Shaktipat from the universe, or a lightning bolt, or some fortuitous set of circumstances that allows for that moment of release from suffering, but to be able to create the conditions on my own for that to happen, taking advantage of the fact that I'm not on my own, that there are infinite resources available to me if I'm willing to open myself to them. But it's not easy. It's easy to say. It ain't easy to do. That's the point.
That's what our creativity is about.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say, to respond to what you're saying, there's a couple of things. One is that, just as a footnote, I'm not sure I would even differentiate the ego from the wounding. That they're one and the same thing, but to kind of tie it back to Laura's image about the cave, the egoic pain of wound, the sense of being wounded is something, is one of the shadows that we find ourselves fixated on, and what our, we're advocating is that we can change our relationship to that, to actually, you know, functionally by this process of self-observation, by this process of turning on our consciousness in and around our attention being drawn to that in such a way that we affect the release that you're referring to. Now, whether we want to construe that release and that expansiveness we feel as bliss, you know, again, that's an exercise for the practitioner. You know, maybe that's what bliss is. You've succeeded in defining it in terms of absence of something else. I'm not sure I'm willing to do that, but you know, that's it's a good working definition for a while.
Peace is another word that belongs.
But I want to make a distinction here. I'm not talking about. You might be talking about, but I'm not talking about something that's just creativity. Okay, it's true that genuinely being present in the moment is inherently creative, but it is not, the obverse is not true, that simply being creative is a step on the process that Stuart and I are talking about, which is to actually change the relationship to the entropy of being an organism, or having an organism, or being associated with an organism. It's getting to that point that we were talking about earlier, where you have a critical mass which is cutting karma faster than karma is being generated. That is something that requires a coherent, persistent practice that is not just being creative. Wonderful as being creative is, and wonderful as feeling momentary moments of release is, those are not in and of themselves this other thing that we're talking about doing. So that's the distinction I would make there.
Yeah.
I'd like to get back to something that you were talking about right at the beginning, Rob, and that somebody down here said something about comfort and self-worth and security. Mm-hmm. I think if you think about bliss as just a higher order of pleasure, then at least for me, that automatically triggers this part of me that's just this little burrowing animal that just wants to, you know, feel better now, you know, get away from that pain, don't think about getting older, don't get about, you know, sickness. And it's, it stimulates more of that kind of self.
You're right.
Not really.
Isn't that a shame? But it does seem to work that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Manichaeism suggested earlier that it's not really just about, you know, some kind of terminal pleasure state. But
right.
It does contain, you know, everything, your own crucifixion and other people's.
Yeah, that was
really. Like, I remember in, like, the really early 70s, like 1970s, seeing this really famous Swami on 60 Minutes. He was being interviewed, and he said something like, or Mike Wallace was saying, well, you know, so this absent state you're in, you don't, you know, everything's illusion. So you don't, Hiroshima was an illusion, and yes, illusion. And I was just mortally offended by that, but he was just saying, okay, you know, this blissful state that I'm in or that you could all be in is about an absolutist thing, and it's excluding, you know, this other thing. It's excluding the relative. It's excluding, excluding a sense of, well, you know, I can't say that I understand the state that he is in or was in, but it's kind of an interesting mix of, you know, you need to get away from this little burrowing animal that's burrowing into the relative, and, like, just make myself feel a little better, you know, in the moment, and that's all I need, as opposed to just being completely identified with all the suffering in the world, completely identified with just pleasure. I mean, nihilism is complicated. It's not just, you know, about some absolutist state that you arrive at.
Absolutely, I agree with that. I mean, the direction I would point you to, though, is not getting away from that little animal, but is subjecting that animal to ever greater scrutiny, making that little animal your object of meditation. And that's how to get through to the place where as in the Buddhist Sutra I happened to be reading yesterday, you know, the Buddha says, you know, I'm in this place where everything is perfect, everything is wonderful, and he moves his foot and the light starts coming out of the earth and everybody starts glowing and it's like, and everybody's going, wow, that's really cool. Well, my suggestion is that the Buddha had to do something like examining the little squirmy animal inside to be able to get to the place where every horror is side by side with every perfection, and they are all inescapably tied together. When we get big enough to encompass that, that's an accomplishment, obviously. But the way to start is not to aim for that first. The way to start is to come to understand and move towards the squirmy little animal inside each of us, as opposed to, you know, letting it scare us away, to move in the opposite direction.
I want to make just one clarifying point, because the term scrutiny is can be misleading. When we look at the squirmy animal, we're not trying to change it. We're not trying to improve it or shift it or make it go away or anything like that. We're, as purely as possible, we're simply trying to put as full attention on it as possible to see what it is. And then, as I said, you know, the nature takes care of itself. That attention actually alchemically causes a change in that aspect of ourselves. We don't have to do anything. And in fact, when we try to do something, we muck up the process.
And because these agendas are never pure. So the agenda we advocate, as Stuart says, is an agenda without an object, except to be present. Except to be present. Did you raise your hand?
Well, would that mean that then, if within me, in addition to a squirmy animal, I happen to have a huge capacity for love or a taste for something great, that I could use that as my object of scrutiny?
Why not both?
I mean, but what I'm saying is, because sometimes I hear us focusing on the limitations again, mm-hmm. just to bring it up, that in as much as we also feel the smallness, we have moments of greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And
of course,
we could use the same process to really be present with those experiences.
Yes. The challenge here, and this is, you know, I'm not asserting that you're doing this, but the challenge is, you know, when we look at the squirmy animal or darker shadows in ourselves, the role in the practice is to disidentify. When we look at the profound parts of ourselves, the most glorious, best aspects of ourselves, the purpose is to disidentify. And it's far less satisfying.
There's the bliss of sacrifice for you.
Do you have a question?
Oh, I was just, you know, following both of those. Not to stay on that aerobic exercise idea, but the idea of Pete of you know, the bliss, but you know, its cousin joy. It was some time ago. I was thinking, you know, I think I kind of get joy, but I realized for me it was, you know, a large component of that was peace. And it's only through, and I found only through a certain practice, kind of like an exercise, you know, and then the heart rate, I mean, an equivalent, you know, is different. But the heart rate, I noticed when I started exercising in a regular fashion, that my resting heart rate does indeed lower itself by disciplined practice. But I don't just go to the gym or ride my bike once a year to do that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think with a practice, I find that I do achieve in those resting moments a greater measure of peace, by which then I was just kind of thinking of what you were saying about love, about, you know, that's when I can really kind of just express gratitude for really no reason at all and no direction. And then there's the other part, you know, it's when I first came in, following your dread, and I was thinking about this, you know, this, it's good news to me. It's that small bliss, it's those small steps, of just recognizing. So on one hand, it's making room for gratitude and for love by a practice and opening that up to allow myself the peace of mind and the clarity to be able to do that. And it's also those recognitions in kind of a joy in following a new dread, if you will, a dread that I'm less attached to than maybe a previous one. And so I guess it's a good news. Just I was thinking of the word dreadlock. Yeah, no, I'm glad I don't have dreadlocks. That's good. That's good to
recognize. Yeah, it is. And actually, Rob was saying this earlier that one develops an appetite for that kind of dread. And it's actually there's a very funny kind of place where it is a funny place in practice where one can see the arising of something that one would normally dread in oneself, but also be so much bigger than that that one can kind of accommodate and move towards it. And that's a wonderful place because it actually allows that it allows that aspect to and that energy to start to move about and to move into a less frozen place. And it is very expansive.
I would additionally just mention that I think you're absolutely right about the sense of peace. To me, when you're talking about peace, that to me is a way to talk about non-attachment. And non-attachment is kind of the key thing. But it's useful occasionally, and this is, you know, maybe because of the strengths and weaknesses of the fourth way of the Tao tradition. We also remind people that non-attachment can arise in a place that doesn't look peaceful at all. That is, I can be totally non-attached when, by outward appearances, I'm really moving my ass, or I'm really doing whatever manifestation it happens to be. It's not what you're doing. It's always how you're doing it. Now, as we learn ever to experience non-attachment is a good thing. And given the sort of culture we are living in, the tendency is to have to go first to a less busy place to find that. But it's also true that we can cultivate non-attachment at the most apparently frenetic exterior place, because it's not an exterior what, it's an interior how. So just throwing that in there as well.
I think we have time for one question.
It's more of a comment. I feel like a kid in grade school right now waiting to raise his hand because all this talk about small animal has brought the memory of a short poem. Sit on a rock at Blind Beach. Watch red-tailed hawk hold his station in a ridge high current. Say the name of your quarry. The small animal curled in your heart knows the pain of being something larger on never-ending wings.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's a good place to...
good place to conclude.
Yes.
I will... We can...
Well, you should talk about our workshop.
Yes. There's we have a very specific... context where people can explore some of this stuff. It's actually a set of practices where we practice putting attention not just on ourselves but on another being. It's called a practice called co-meditation. It's a two-person meditation form. We're going to be doing a workshop this Saturday here at our Tayu house just outside town here from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So if you're interested, contact Inara here, or Alan over there, or Stuart or myself, or Ann over there, and let us know. Similarly, we have a it's a group that meets most Tuesdays now. The next meeting will be this next Tuesday here in the store at 7:30 p.m. And the title of the group is Dude, Where's My Soul? So we're looking at the intersection of the phenomenal and non-phenomenal realms in our lives and how we can get reliable information about that. And is there anything else coming up that I need to mention?
No.
Okay.
Take it away.
Take it away.
Thank you very much for coming. I want to make a few quick announcements. One is...